My name is Janine McGaha-Williams, and I am an alcoholic. And because this program works, the grace of a loving God, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink since January the 25th, 1977. And that is truly a miracle. It's funny that I asked to have Jeff introduce me, because Jeff has been responsible for me speaking at three different roundups every year, this being the third, for the last 3 years. And, you know, the changes that take place in us in this program are incredible, because I knew that Jeff hated my guts for years, you know. He was not real discreet about it. He would glare, you know. And when he called, when I heard the first time that 3 years ago that Jeff had recommended me for to speak at a roundup, I thought, well, that's wonderful, you know, that is really great that we've healed. It is my honesty, I think, that has saved my life. It is probably my honesty. Can you hear me?
Do I have to do this? Oh, my God. I feel like a rock singer.
Yeah. It is my honesty also that is probably one of my biggest, can be, one of my biggest character defects. And, you know, when you first come in, and if you make a list when you first get here, these are the good things about me, these are the bad things about me, and then go back and look at that in 5 years, and you can change good to bad, bad to good, half the time. And that's really been true for me. I was born on August the 4th, 1946, right at the end of the war, right at the end of WW2. And the day that I was born, it was 110 degrees in Dallas, Texas, and there was no air conditioning. And I broke out instantly in a heat rash that covered my entire body except for the palms of my hands and the soles of my feet. Consequently, it was very painful, evidently, to touch me. And that set up, that was the first bad thing that happened to me. And it was downhill from there. My mother had to have some other surgery, so they took me away from her immediately, and I didn't see her again for 2 or 3 weeks. And so I had this horrible heat rash. I was taken away from the only person I knew when I was born, and they sent me home to stay with my grandmother while my mother was in the hospital, and she was giving me a bottle, and she couldn't understand why I wasn't nursing, and it took her 2 days to realize that the nipple had no hole in it. So I was starving to death. And I once heard somebody say, you know, my earliest recollection of feeling was, it's not safe to be here. And that's where I started. My mother always used to say that she thought that I was born angry, and she was right. She was absolutely right. I was the second child. I'm an adult child of an alcoholic. My father came back from the war an alcoholic, and still is practicing alcoholic today, age 67. I had a brother that was 5 years old when I was born. I was the baby until I was 12, and I was spoiled rotten. When I was 12, my family converted to Catholicism, and when I was 12 years old, we had my first little sister. When I was 13, we had the next, and when I was 14, we had the next. And then my mother took to her bed for 5 years and put me up front to raise these three kids. So I went from being this spoiled, rotten little kid to mother of three at age 12. And the best way I can ever think to describe it is, I was not pleased. I was not pleased at all. I was very, very angry. I also took my mother's place on the front line of the abuse of my father's disease. The message was all the time when I was growing up, I'm doing this for you. I'm doing this for you. You know, why do you stay with him? Why do you let him beat you up? I do this for you. What does that do to your head, you know? And then it was like when I was 12 or 13, when she took to her bed, it was like, now it's your turn, and you have to do it. And this is interesting because I've only come in contact with this, I've only figured this out this year in my 12th year of sobriety. It nearly killed me because here was my dirty little secret. She said, I depend on you to defend me from him and to save me and Huey, Dewey, and Louie, my three little sisters, from him. And I said, I will. I said, I will. My dirty little secret was I had to make a decision to save my own sanity, and that decision was, I'm lying. I will do my best to save you and these three kids, but when it comes down to it, and it will, I'm going to save myself. And for how many years, from 12 to 42, 30 years, I lived with the guilt that in my mind, I had killed my mother and my three sisters, because I would have. 30 years it took me to come up with that, and it's been the most freeing experience of sobriety that I had lived with that. There was something wrong with me, because my concept of love coming out of that family was, if you love somebody, you are willing to die for them. And that was always the litmus test of love in my family. Would you die for me? I would die for you. I would die for you. We used to say that all the time. Yeah, but he'd die for us. You know, well, you know how seldom anyone needs to die for you? You know how often you need them to talk to you? That would be nice. You know how often you need them to be there for you? A lot more often than you need them to fucking die for you, baby. You know? And of course, I certainly believe, since we judge everyone else by ourselves, that they were just saying that when the, you know, when the shit hit, it was going to be every man for himself, and I knew that. You know? I was watching the exits all the time. Still do that today. I always sit at an AA meeting on the side with my back to a wall. Anybody in Dallas will tell you this, because to this day, I can't stand for people to sit behind me. You know? Anyway. So, from the only thing I wanted to do growing up was get the hell out of that house. I lived for the day that I would get out of that house. And so when I was 18, I did. And moved to Dallas. I grew up in Grand Prairie, Texas. And I moved to Dallas, which Grand Prairie being a suburb of Dallas. And went to work. And I didn't drink. I never drank normally, the few times that I did. But I didn't drink because I saw what it did to my father. And I was not going to do that. Period. I was not going to do it. But when I was fairly normal as far as I got, my first job lasted a year. I showed up, I was, you know, employable. I got a better job, and that lasted 2 years. And then I got a better job. So I'd had, you know, a succession of three better jobs by the time I was 22. I got married. I had gone with this guy from the time I was 12. And he was the first person I ever told I was gay. And he didn't bat an eye. I'll never forget it. And he said, well, as long as you don't fool around with other men, it'll be okay. He said, girls always hug and kiss. Janine, there's nothing wrong with you. That sounded good. I went with that. I always knew I was going to marry him, see, so I wouldn't sleep with him. I slept with four or five other guys, but I wouldn't sleep with him because I knew I was going to marry him. And the sad thing was, he hadn't slept with anyone else. He was a virgin, and I had a big time guilt about that. See, I always thought that you said one thing and did another. I mean, that's called being polite. You know? That's manners. And it was always a huge shock to me when I found out I was the only one doing it and everybody else was telling the truth, you know? God, you really are a virgin? Oh, my God. Me too, me too. I was living with my first lover when we got married. She was my maid of honor. They got along really well. I seemed to be the odd man out all the time, you know, and it was very disturbing, and I got real upset about my sexuality then, and it was the only time I've ever been promiscuous in my life was right after I got married, which would make sense if you knew me, you know, make this commitment to monogamy, and obviously you're going to go screw everybody in Dallas, you know, say you won't, and I will. And I was sleeping with like five men and five women simultaneously and had a live-in lover and this husband. And not getting a lot of rest or eating regularly. And finally, I couldn't handle it, and I was working second shift and not drinking. It was really awful. It would have been better if I had had some rest, you know, some drinking to give me some anesthesia. But I couldn't take it anymore. I was really, it was the first time I was really going crazy, I think. And I looked in the Yellow Pages under, I never could do anything, honestly. Never. And I knew I needed to get some help. I knew I needed to see a psychologist, but I couldn't say that, even to myself. So what I said was, I'm really interested in finding out my past lives, and so I need to find a hypnotist to hypnotize me, to regress me, you know, to find out what my past lives were. So I looked in the Yellow Pages under hypnotist. But I was very careful to find one that said psychologist also. And I called her and I said, you know, I'm interested in past life regressions. Do you do that? And she said, yes, but first I would have to have 1 hour with you to make sure that you're well enough in this lifetime to deal with other lives. And I thought, this is my woman. This is the person I need. And I went over there. And it was really wonderful. I had been so blessed with therapists. I've always had good therapists. And I started immediately going, oh, I'm so miserable and crying hysterically. And she said, Jean, what do you feel like is the problem? I said, I'm a homosexual. And she said, that's not a problem. And she wasn't gay. And she said, you know, the problem is 9 of these people need to be eliminated. Pick any 9 at all. And I did that. I did that, and I made a conscious decision right then. I was 22, and I decided on a woman. And I haven't slept with a man since. Not even drunk, I didn't. Well, I'm really grateful for that. Excuse me. 50% of the audience, don't worry about it. Anyway, I came out, and there are people here from Dallas that were here when I first came in, and so they remember this. When I first got sober in 1977, we had 2 or 3 members out of the 8 or 10 people that were in the Together group in Dallas, the gay AA group, that were having tremendous problems dealing with their sexuality. And I would always say, rude person that I am, what's the fucking deal? What is the big deal? I just came out and never had a problem with it. Why are you know, what are you going on about it? What is the big deal? And I told my mother that when I was about 3 or 4 years sober. I was telling her about somebody I was working with. I couldn't figure out why they were having such problems with their sexuality. And she said to me, Jeanine, you stayed drunk 7 years after that. And I had never made that connection. That's when I started drinking, when I came out. I divorced my husband. I made a decision about my sexuality. And I started going to the gay bars. And I started to drink. And I never, never drank normally. I'm a firm believer that I was an alcoholic before I ever drank. I don't know what the explanation is for that. I have a tendency to believe that it is a genetic predisposition as from being a child of an alcoholic. I know that in 3 months, I was drinking in the morning. That's not a normal progression. So I was like an instant alcoholic. I came out when I was 22, really came out, and started going to the bars. In 3 weeks, I met a woman at a bar in Dallas that was in Dallas on business from New York. And I knew her 2 weeks, and I left Dallas and moved to New York City with this woman. That's not normal. That's not what we call good judgment, you know? And I lived up there. She was an alcoholic, and I lived up there 5 years, and that's what we did. We drank. And I was drinking in the morning in 3 months. I was having blackouts in 3 months. And it was awful. I had no idea until I got to AA that alcohol was a depressant. I did not. I always thought it was a stimulant, that it made me feel better, you know. Here I was in this major depression taking a depressant and wondering why it wasn't working. What's the problem? I'm taking more and more of this, and it's getting worse and worse. I should take more and more and more and more. That'd work, you know. And it was really terrible. I got absolutely suicidal several times while I was up there. But I got arrested by the police. I was driving on the sidewalk through Washington Square Park. And as I rounded the fountain, these 2 big cops were walking towards me. And I thought I was on the street, and I thought they should get out of the street. So I didn't swerve, you know. And they were not real amused. I was charged with more than Al Capone. I was charged with attempted murder, and I ran over garbage cans that was like destroying public property and resisting arrest, and they beat me half to death. And I remember this girl that was with me, they had me on the ground with my arms up behind me like that, and they were kicking me and hitting me with their nightsticks. And I remember she said, "Janine, if you'll stop cussing them out, they'll quit kicking you." And I don't know, it was just awful. But I was in jail 16 hours, and when I got out the next day, I had 16 hours to think this situation over. What was wrong? What had gone wrong? And I figured it out. I should never have taken the car into the city. And I never did again. Consequently, I used to wake up on the park subway cars in the lots at 7 o'clock in the morning, on Monday morning a lot, and I'd go, "Oh, God, you know, I missed my stop." Which was New Jersey. I was a little slow. You know, the denial of this disease never ceases to amaze me. It is actually amusing to me now to listen to people's denial mechanisms. Do you remember Bean T? He used to say he got to where he was passing out at 8 o'clock, and he was missing all the network movies, and he kept going, "What's the problem? What's the problem?" And so he bought a VCR. That fixed it, you know. The denial is incredible, you know. It's like the essence of the disease to me is the denial. I drank like that. I never drew another day of sober breath for 7 years, and I hit my bottom. I ended up living on the street in San Francisco at one point in a dead Volkswagen bus with a certified by the government insane person and a big dog. Living in this Volkswagen bus in front of Maud's lesbian bar in San Francisco. We weren't bathing. We were living on beef jerky and boiled eggs. It was terrible. It was really terrible. I hit a bottom there. I certainly hit my financial bottom there because for the first 5 years that I drank, I managed to work. And, I was fairly acceptable. But I kept having almost out-of-body experiences, and I would see myself in that situation, and I'd think, "I can't believe this is happening to me." You know? I didn't come from a well-to-do family at all. I mean, it was probably lower middle class, but I was not raised to live on the street in San Francisco. I was not equipped to do that. You know, and I was too proud to write hot checks. I made someone else do it. And I was too proud to panhandle. I made her do it. You know? It was just the degradation of it. Only the people in this room can know. And I don't care if you lived in a mansion in the finest part of town, the degradation is horrible. And I have known people that had really high bottoms financially, and when they tell their story, it tears my guts out. Because the degradation, unless it's happened to you, you can't relate to it. And obviously, all of you know what I'm talking about. I made a deal with God out there on the street. I'm a recovering Catholic, so I'm real big on making deals with God. I said, "God, if you'll get me back to Dallas one more time," because I had done about 15 geographicals. I even spent 2 summers in the middle of the desert in Nevada going, "How did I get here?" Drunk. But I said, "God, if you'll get me back to Dallas one more time, I will get myself together." And what I meant by that was I will get a regular job, which I hadn't had in 2 years, and I will get my own car and a lover that's not an alcoholic or a drug addict. And I got back to Dallas by stealing a lot of money, which probably wasn't God's idea. It was probably mine, I have a feeling. But I got back to Dallas, and I did that. I dumped this crazy person and found someone, and I need to tell you how I build relationships. What I did was, I said, "Well, now I got the job," so I told God that I'd get the decent lover. So I went to TJ's, which was an old dive bar in Dallas at the time, and it was like a Tuesday night. There were only 4 women in there, and one of them was drinking Coke, and she moved in with me the next day, and we lived together 2.5 years. That's how I built relationships. Next. I stayed with her. We were together 2.5 years, but when we had been together a year, I bought a car that was in a dead woman's name for $100. Sobriety is the easier, softer way. Every year, I had that car for two or three years, and every year I would try. It cost me a fortune to get it inspected and the license tags because it's in this dead woman's name, you know. So anyway, I had the car, and I had the lover that wasn't an alcoholic, and I had the job, and I was still miserable. I mean, miserable. And on January the 25th, 1977, for one thing, and I forget to tell this sometimes when I tell my story, January the 24th, it was the week of our one, it's going to be the week of our, my lover and I's 1 year anniversary. And we had both been taking turns on the phone calling people to have this big anniversary celebration. Well, at this point, I don't know how many of you this happened to, but it's really scary. At this point, my consumption level had become very strange. Sometimes I could still have like a quart of scotch and function and talk, and then some nights I could have two beers and lose all motor function. And it got totally unpredictable. It was really scarier than the predictable fall down had been. And what happened on January the 24th, one thing that happened was my mind, and this was really terrible, I got to where I couldn't black out. I liked those blackouts, you know? And my mind was crystal clear, but I had lost the ability to speak. And those of you who know me, it was a fate worse than death. You know, when I died, they're going to have to tape my mouth shut to get me to, you know, to be quiet. And I thought I had had a stroke. I was convinced that I had had a stroke because I was going, and drooling and stuff, you know. So I laid there before I passed out. And I said, God, if you'll just give me back my speech, I'll do anything. I must admit it. I know that it had been a progression since I'd owned the fact that possibly alcohol was a problem in San Francisco a year earlier. And the next morning, sometime in my sleep, and a lot of things happened to me asleep. God works on me when I'm asleep. I woke up the next morning and I felt dead. I mean, to have committed suicide would have been redundant because I literally felt dead. You know, I have lost a lot of people to this disease since I've been in the program, and I've got it very clearly that people don't die because they're angry. People don't kill themselves because they're sad. People don't kill themselves, but for one reason, folks, apathy. People that kill themselves, it's because they're already dead, and it seems wrong to walk around dead. Now, one of two things happens, I've found out since then, when you reach that place, you either have a miracle happen in your life or you kill yourself. I have to believe that 51% of me wanted to live that day, because here I am. I didn't care if I died. Life was so bleak to me at that point. I really didn't care if I died. As a matter of fact, I was more afraid of not dying. One of my deals was, I'll never live to be 21. I'll never live to be 25. I won't have to pay the rent on the first of the month. I'll be dead. You know, one day at a time was how I had always lived, particularly after I started drinking. I know today that's because I wished I was dead. Normal people, I was not psychic like I thought I was. You know, I'm not going to live to be 21, meant I don't plan to. I don't want to. And I got afraid that I wasn't going to die. And I couldn't take the pain anymore. I just could not take the pain anymore. So my lover got up, and I said, I'm not going to work, which was not a very unusual thing. She said, well, what are you going to do? And I said, I'm going to call Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't know where that came from, except that by the grace of God, I had never let anyone talk to me about my alcoholism. I had never talked to anyone else about it, period. I woke up, and it doesn't happen that way. You don't go to sleep drunk after at the end of a seven-year drunk and wake up and go, well, I just think I'll call AA. That was a miracle. It's absolutely a miracle. I didn't care if I lived or died, but I had it real clear that I never, never wanted to be drunk again. Someone was speaking at a workshop earlier today, and he said he could remember his last drunk. I think it might have been Jeff. Somebody was. And I can still physically experience what that felt like, particularly when I'm working with somebody that's really new. I can look at you and go, oh, it just starts, oh, good. Just totally empathize. And I'm really, truly grateful for that today. I truly am, because I believe that the day I forget that last drunk, I'm going to have another one. And the old-timers that I know, the people that stay sober a long time, that seems to be the case. I have instant recall of the degradation, the humiliation, the pain. It's so clear to me today. It's like it happened 11 days ago instead of 11 years ago, and I'm grateful for that. All I wanted to do was learn how to put the plug in the jug. It was the only problem I had. And I went to AA that night, and there were 8 members of Gay Alcoholics Anonymous, and the only thing I remember hearing that night was they asked me if I believed in God, and I told them I did. And they said, if you want to stay sober, get on your knees in the morning and ask God to keep you clean and sober for 24 hours. And I knew instantly that would work. Instantly. I had prayed for years, God, please don't let me get as drunk tonight as I got drunk last night. And that never worked. And I couldn't figure out why it didn't work. But I had never asked him to keep me sober because I didn't want to be sober until the day I did. I feel so sorry for people that come in here and think they might have a problem with alcohol. And I tell them, new people now, I say, if you're not sure, leave now. Leave now because you are making the biggest mistake of your life that's going to fuck up your drinking forever. Because it's true. And I feel so sorry for them, you know. I've heard so many old-timers say, there's nothing in the world worse than a head full of AA and a belly full of booze. I feel so bad for those people, you know. But I was through. I've never met anybody that was more through drinking than I was. I mean, I would have done anything. Anything. And I was so amazed at the little that they asked me to do. Ha! You know, as if I knew what they were talking about. I got through the steps in a year and was convinced that I'm done now, you know, and started working, you know, started working with other people. And it's never been hard for me to stay sober. It has been hard for me to stay alive because I have always known that I will only drink one more time. So I don't think of it as maybe I might have a slip. I do think I might die. A lot of times I've thought, I think I might die, because that's what drinking means for me. I'm convinced that I've got another drunk in me, but I don't have another sobering up. I don't have it. And so I don't know. The process has been very gradual. I need to tell you that 10 days after, well, at 3.5 years sober, I gave up alcohol January the 25th, 1977. That was all I gave up. And when I was 3.5 years sober, I had a lover that was also in the program. We were in business together, and it was complicated, but she started drinking again after 1.5 years sobriety, and she committed suicide and killed my dog and basically big time fucked up my life. And at that point, I had to give up suicide. When I was 3.5 years sober, I gave up suicide as an option. But what I didn't know, folks, until February the 5th this year, is I still had another option. Going crazy. I said to my little self, if it gets too bad, I'm going crazy. And I did. 10 days after my 11th AA birthday, it got too bad, and I said, this is it. This is the day I've waited for. I'm out of here. Conscious decision. I'm gone now. Woo! Left. Just left. It was wonderful. It was just one of the most wonderful things that ever happened to me in the beginning. It got bad after the first few days, but I think now, I need to tell you, one of the things that happened to me, and people, get confused because I tell these things. And I was saying to some Jeff or somebody yesterday, I said, these three angels were talking to me, and they told me so-and-so. And they go, what, when, Janine? When I was crazy. When I was crazy. Not today, you know. I had the most incredible delusions. They were absolutely wonderful. And one of them was about this little airplane. I had a lot of psychic revelations. And one of the ones that I couldn't figure out was I had this whole deal, this whole delusion about this little biplane and this little aviatrix that was this tall that had on that little leather hat and the scarf blowing back. And I've been saying, you know, that's one I can't figure out, because I figured out what most of them were about as time has gone on since February. And I saw that program yesterday and went, oh, it's my aviatrix with a little hat on and everything, you know. It's really great. The one thing I can't put together is this little aviatrix somehow crashed her plane in the delusion, and I was at the funeral, and everybody kept standing around saying, boy, she could really lay down those peeps and does. If anybody knows what that means, I hope you'll tell me. Because peeps and does. Everybody kept saying, she could really lay down the peeps and does. But I surrendered to life. What happened to me was, on February the 5th this year, 11 years and 10 days sober, I surrendered to life. The only thing I gave to God, basically important in my life, the first 11 years I was sober, was alcohol. And look how well it worked. But I hadn't noticed that. I was in no way willing to give up control of anything else. I was too terrified. Control has been everything to me all my life. So many things have come to me this year. One of them being, you know, God's will for me is to be happy, joyous, and free. Why does that scare me so bad? God's will for me is to be happy, joyous, and free. But God's will for me is to be happy, joyous, and free. What's wrong with this picture? And I finally got it this year. It's not God's will that I'm afraid of. It is mine. It is my will that I'm afraid of. You may all know that, but it took me 11 years to figure that out. God's will for me, truly, is to be happy, joyous, and free. Period. No ifs, ands, buts, nothing. God's will for me is to be happy, joyous, and free. My will for me is to suffer, to die, to rot, to be drunk and lay on the street, to lose jobs, lose money, have abusive relationships, and die. That's Janine's will. And I spent 11 years going, am I in God's will, or is this my will? Is this God's will or my will? Is this the job God wants me to have? As if I could show up for the wrong job. Because once in a while I was really sure I knew what God's will was. It's that job, the one that pays $40,000 a year. That's God's will for me. And if I miss the bus, I'm going to fuck it up and get the wrong job. I was constantly thinking, I'm going to fuck it up. I'm going to fuck up God's will. You know? I couldn't hear that. Wouldn't I have to be more powerful than God to do that? Why didn't somebody tell me that? Because I wouldn't listen, right, Jeff? So that's, how do I know today that I'm in God's will? If I am comfortable, if I'm at peace and calm, I guarantee you I'm in God's will. If my stomach is upset from nerves, if I am tense, if I am stressed out, unhappy, my will, every time. It's not complicated at all. When I am uncomfortable, my will, always, always, always. That has really helped. That has really helped me a lot. Also, another thing that I got through this deal is, I personally believe in reincarnation. I don't care what you believe. Doesn't matter. I don't need to convince you. But I personally believe in reincarnation. And one of the things that the angels told me when I was in La La Land was that spiritual growth is an absolute, guaranteed. Everyone is called, and everyone will get it. And the only difference in me and someone who is behind me is time. And the only difference in me and someone that is ahead of me is time. I have nothing that is not available to you, and you have nothing that is not available to me. It is an absolute. We will all get back to God, which is where we are heading, and I can't fuck it up. The worst. The worst that I can do is temporarily delay it. Now, I don't want to do that any more than I have to. I don't want to, but it's okay if I do. It's just okay. I don't make mistakes anymore. I have given up on making mistakes. I simply make decisions. And someone with about 3 months sobriety, when I was about 8 or 10 years sober, taught me that. I had done a real estate deal with a friend of mine. Good research, good data, good deal. Turned sour. And don't get involved in business with friends. I've heard that all my life. And I was having this major agony and bumming everybody out day after day at the meetings talking about it. I feel so bad. I should have known. I should have done this. I should have done that. And this kid with 3 months sobriety said, well, if you had the same information to bring me is time. And the only difference in me and someone that is ahead of me is time. I have nothing that is not available to you, and you have nothing that is not available to me. It is an absolute. We will all get back to God, which is where we are heading, and I can't fuck it up. So I make a decision, and I sometimes put expectations on what the outcome is going to be. That's human. I'm going to do that. If it doesn't turn out that way, so what? You know, if I don't have the information, I don't have the information. Who do I think I am, you know? And so I think to myself, now, if I had the same information today, would I make the same decision? Yes. It's a big deal, you know? Character judgments I have a problem with. I really don't. You can count on it. I will pick the abusive person out of any 100. It's very predictable. I'm trying to do it different. I'm trying to do relationships different. I'm trying to get to know someone before I marry them, which is very unique for me. It's never happened before. Another codependent person. Or a victim, one or the other. And I'm trying today in working with others. I've got it, but I don't know what you should do. And that's cutting you guys a big break, because I used to know exactly what you should do. Always I knew exactly what you should do. One of the hardest concepts in our time, just sitting there going, right. What you should do is, oh, it's you know. But one of the hardest concepts for me to get was, everybody's doing the best they can. Ha! Who was doing the best? I didn't know anybody that couldn't do better. And I said that often. You could do better. You know, I could do better. We could all do better. I don't get it. You're wrong. We're not doing the best we can. Someone's in an abusive situation, right? It's obvious to everybody. It's an abusive situation. They're sitting there. They're sitting there, and they're sitting there, and they're sitting there. We're all getting gray-headed, and they're sitting there. And, you know, the deal is now, obviously, they don't have everything they need right now to get out of it. There's something missing, because, folks, nobody wants to be unhappy. Nobody wants to be unhappy. I hate new people that come in and go, well, I'm choosing to have a good day. Right, you made a decision, and, you know, the whole world has seen fit to fall in place with your decision, you know. Bullshit, you're having a good day and you're taking credit for it. That's the way I feel about you. Then let me remind you that now you're choosing to have a bad day. I don't choose to have bad days. Maybe you do, but I don't. I'm not nuts anymore, and I'm not stupid. If there's something wrong in my life, and you can see what I need to do about it, it's very obvious to you, please know there's something today lacking in me. And the minute I have everything I need to change that situation, to extricate myself from that relationship, to go up to the boss and say, shove it up your ass, I will do it. The minute I'm capable of doing that, I will do it. Sometimes I don't know myself. What's missing? What do I need here? What's missing that I can't fix this? Something is, always. You're doing the best you can. Every one of you here tonight is doing the best you can. I'm doing the best I can. That's all I can do. You know, God expects me to show up, work 8 hours, play 8 hours, sleep 8 hours. I can do that. And that is such a relief to me. I can do that today. Thanks to you people. You know, the first thing you had to do, it took you 5 years to raise me, to make me employable, to teach me how to dress again. Because my self-image was so bad when I got here. I had 2 pairs of blue jeans and 3 sweatshirts, which I had bought on sale at the Goodwill. Okay? And they weren't ratty enough, so I had to tear them and paint in them. And, you know, I was not socially acceptable when I got here. But I was doing the best I could. So it took you a long time just to teach me how to dress. To be able to tie 3 sentences together coherently. You know, my sponsor said to me, he said, Janine, you have to change everything about you. When I first got here, he said, you're going to have to change everything about you or you will die. He said, if you put your right shoe on first, put your left shoe on first. I want you to drive to work every morning a different way. I want you to come home a different way. If you brush your teeth first, do your hair first. Change. It was very simple. Things were very basic for me when I got here. I had to become less intractable. I had to become teachable. You know, I have waited for going on almost 12 years now to find out what you people were trying to tell me. What's the deal? You know, what is the deal? We had an example of it today. What are these 12 steps trying to tell me? If I can just get it, then I can rest, right? The whole purpose of the deal is, like, if a person's starving to death and you give them a fish, they eat for one night. If you teach them how to fish, they can eat the rest of their lives. The whole purpose for me of the 12 steps is to make me teachable and flexible and to be able to accept change, because you don't know what's going to happen to me. And I hate that. I wish you did. I wish I could be prepared for life. See, all I had ever wanted was to be prepared for life. And as soon as you learn one lesson, they change the deal. And that's what I hate, you know, that's part of being also an adult child and alcoholic. I hate change. We nailed the fucking furniture down because I didn't want anybody to move it, you know. There was so little stability in my life that the few things that I could control, I controlled like this. I took a trip when I was 6 years old, the only trip I ever took, with my grandmother out of town for 2 weeks. And I told my mother, don't change anything. Don't change anything. And I came home, and I tore through the house to make sure everything was exactly the same. And they had put a new faucet on the bathroom sink. And I said, where is it? Where is my faucet? That's nuts. You know, I was that crazy up until February this year. Do not change anything. I would stick with something abusive and bad rather than change it. Page 73 in the 12 and 12 I read today, because Jeff pointed it out to me. He has a T-shirt. Did you talk about that last night? Someone from out of town gave him a T-shirt at our roundup that says Rebellion Dogs Club or something like that. And he thought, what the hell is this? And he saw in a little tiny print down at the bottom, page 73 of the 12 and 12. And so he went over and read it. And it's the page about how we resist change, about how we resist spiritual growth. And one of the lines is, and rebellion dogs are every step. And it's the Rebellion Dogs Club. That was me. Every single step of spiritual growth I have made, I have been dragged through kicking and screaming. And my sponsor used to say, there's another way to live. To me, there's another way. But it was the only way I had. And it was enough, because I'm here. I'm here today, and that's a miracle. You know, I read recently that less than 1% of the members of Alcoholics Anonymous stay sober, continuous sobriety for 10 years. And I remember the first meeting that I went to. Recently, this guy said to me, he said, well, I was here a year ago, and I was in the hospital, and he was with me. That's what it was. That was a different story. One of the first meetings I went to, there were 5 of us sitting there, and the guy that was chairing the meeting said, statistically, only one of us will be sober a year from now. And this guy was there, that's right. And he came back in a few months ago, and he said, you remember you were at that first meeting that I went to? You were brand new, too. And that stupid asshole said, a year from now, only one of us will be sober out of the five of us. And then he said, I just walked out. There's a little bucket. There's no hope. And I said, you know, I had forgotten that. I was sitting there thinking, what in the hell is going to happen to you poor guys? So who gives a shit, you know? If one person is going to stay sober 10 years, I wonder what's going to happen to those other folks. It's going to be me. You know, I don't care. So it's all in how you look at all the help is there. All the help that you need. The minute you're ready, the student, you know, the student's ready, the teacher appears, and we get our lessons in the strangest places, the very strangest places. I had never been so calm in my life when I spoke. I feel almost boring. I can take that. I can live with that. When I was getting ready to come speak tonight, I was taking so much care about the way I looked. And I wouldn't care if all you guys had on cut-off jeans, I would have on these clothes, because I owe that to you. I owe it to you to be the best Janine that I can be today. And what I am today, I owe to you. I feel towards you almost like a lover. I feel that I can reach out and embrace this whole audience. Because you took me to raise, you know, there's a definition of home. Home is that place where if you have to go there, they have to let you in. At the end of my drinking, they didn't. They said, get away from the door, we're calling the police, you know. And when I first came in, that was the thing I latched on to. They said, the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. I said, you mean that? You mean that? You mean that? Yes. And I tell you, that the person that I find most socially unacceptable, the person whose personality is most abrasive in AA, I would fight to the death for your right to be here. Because this is the lifeboat. I have a fatal disease. It is in daily remission, sometimes hourly, sometimes moment to moment, and so is yours. And I don't wish anybody dead because they're obnoxious. And that's what I'm wishing you. If I wish you out of this room, then I wish you dead. Because I don't know about you, but this is the last house on the block for me. And the miracle is that you can't make me leave, because if you could have, you would have. Jeff, it's really good that he told it, because I was famous when I feel towards you almost like a lover. Newcomers hated me. Old people tolerated me. But people were always coming up to me when they were 4, 5, 6 months old, and they said, you know, I hated you when I first got here, but now I really love you. And I would always say, do I know you? Anyway. But there was this one girl, Diane, and she hated me from the minute she laid eyes on me, and I, for some reason, I wanted her to like me. It mattered to me. I worked on that woman. I wanted her to like me, and I could not get along with her. And after about 4 months, we were at a meeting one night, and she said, before the meeting, she said, I'd like to have a word with you outside after the meeting. I said, yes, of course. And all through the meeting, I thought, this is it. This is the night that she's going to tell me. I love you now. You know. And I was just like, this is the way God works on me. And so I sat there just filled with pride. And she took me outside and she said, I promised my sponsor I would tell you this because I did my fifth step. If I'm sober 100 years, I will still hate your fucking guts. Whatever you're doing tonight, keep doing it because you're beautiful. And I thank you very much for having me here.